This is Bristol Bay and Beyond, KDLG's weekly news magazine. It's Friday, May 12th. I'm your host, Dave Benninger. Very glad to have you tuning in today. This week, Pebble and EPA have struck a deal.
What we were after in the settlement was a return to normalized permitting,
which they got, and now must put a plan on the table within 2.5 years. Pebble's CEO Tom Collier joins again this week and will bring you voices from yesterday's rally and press conference loudly in opposition to the deal. We'll visit with a budding area entrepreneur who left a cushy state job to open a new gym in town.
Basically, my main goal is to educate people and teach people how to take care of their bodies, really.
Some graduating seniors will share thoughts on their future in essay and poem.
You no longer care if your eyebrows are on fleek. Who are you trying to impress here anyway? All these people look 12.
And a young Dillingham man sits down with us to share about an addiction that nearly cost him his life and about the road to recovery.
It's like I'm taking the first necessary steps on a journey that I've chosen to take, and I could kind of see where it can lead to.
That's all coming up after a look back at some of this week's news. A major development in the long saga of the Pebble Mine happened today when EPA and Pebble Mine reached in an out-of-court agreement to settle one of three lawsuits. Under the terms, EPA will back off of its proposed preemptive restrictions developed under Obama that would have blocked the mine. Now Pebble can enter the permitting process and must do so within the next 30 months and have an environmental impact statement complete within 4 years. Anticipating the news, dozens, including Gay Lahasith, turned out in Dillingham Thursday to rally against it.
It is a day of disappointment, but you know what? We're going to stand united, and people are going to try to divide us and conquer us, but we're going to stand united and stay firm and get out there and rally what we're doing.
Pebble says they will likely submit a smaller, quote, progressive plan for permitting, perhaps within the year. The agreement met with swift and stern resistance Friday from many who had just a year earlier strongly backed the EPA. New Administrator Scott Pruitt said in a statement that he knows how passionately the community cares about the issue. Gill netters continue to fish Togiak herring, which started a large spawn earlier this week. The seiners closed just shy of their season quota of 16,000 tons Sunday morning. Eight of them plus two buyers then shifted to Port Moeller, where area management biologist Bob Murphy opened up some effort.
We had a 30-hour fishery, and approximately 1,475 tons were caught. Roe percent was good, up at around 12% is what I heard, and they were typically large fish for the first day of the fishery, like 450, 480 grams.
Port Moeller fished herring last year, but only landed about 70 tons. This year's harvest will be one of the bigger on record. Murphy says he recalls there was a harvest of 3,800 tons back in the early 90s. So far, no price for this year's catch has been published. The fault lines in Alaska have been active lately, and a series of strong quakes rocked the Aleutian Islands near Adak Monday morning. A 6.4 magnitude quake shook at about 9 a.m. just 80 miles west of that island. Seismologist Natalia Rupert observed a flurry of aftershocks that continued through the day and into Tuesday. She said while the quakes were not unusual for the region, they did seem to strike in an unusual spot.
This was a shallow crustal earthquake located underneath the island arc. And what we typically see in Aleutian Islands, that the stronger earthquakes are located south of the island arc, more offshore.
The quakes continued on through Tuesday in that similar spot. Another Bristol Bay drug importation case is wrapping up. Two defendants, Alex Savo and Taylor Lack, have or are soon to plead guilty for attempting to bring heroin and meth from Anchorage into King's Salmon. They were caught with the goods when they got off the plane in March 2016. Savo pleaded guilty earlier this month and will serve a 2-year term. Lack is expected to plead guilty today. A young man with a growing criminal history was nabbed again in Dillingham this week. 22-year-old Reese Johnson allegedly broke into a home, waved a gun around, and assaulted people inside. The incident occurred Saturday. Police picked him up a few days later. Johnson was currently serving probation from a gun theft case from last year. A Unalakleet man has been charged with manslaughter for the ATV wreck that killed his passenger last week. State troopers say Ransom Bradley was drinking and driving when he caused the accident that took the life of Kevin Bradley. And a 56-year-old worker at the Togiak Fisheries Cannery near Twin Hills died this week in what troopers say was just an accident. The body of 56-year-old James Schneider, originally from Oregon, was found face down in the mud. They say he may have fallen 15 feet off of the dock. Right now, troopers do not believe alcohol or drugs or foul play were involved, but they're continuing to investigate. More on this week's news can be found at our website, kdlg.org.
My name is Anna Louise Hossett. I'm 17 and I'm a senior at Dillingham High School, and this is my career narrative. I was elected the Bristol Bay Youth Representative during the 2015 Alaska Federation of Natives Elders and Youth Conference. By identifying the positive events and creating solutions for concerning issues in Bristol Bay, I learned I would like to be the Director of Indigenous Leadership with the First Alaskans Institute, which strives to develop Alaska Native leaders. I would like to obtain a career close to home. The First Alaskans Institute is located in Anchorage and provides cultural leadership careers for Alaskan people. Working close to home will allow me to give back to my native community by teaching traditional Alaskan values. In preparation for my career, I have attended leadership conferences such as the Alaska Federations of Natives, College Horizons, and the United National Indian Tribal Youth Conference. These organizations gave me a broad understanding on what it takes to be a Native youth leader. After high school, I will use my leadership skills in college. In the fall of 2017, I will attend Clark College to pursue an associate's degree in general studies. Once I graduate from Clark, I will attend the University of Alaska Fairbanks for a bachelor's degree in Alaskan Native Studies. When I'm a student, I will find an internship with the First Alaskans Institute. And once I graduate from UAF, I will get an entry-level position through the Emerging Native Leaders Organization. In this job, I will discuss and solve issues within the Native community. I will work myself up to becoming the Indigenous Leadership Director. In this position, I will coordinate with elder and youth representatives of each region of Alaska, help develop and host the Elders and Youth Conference at AFN, and this career will allow me to promote and enrich my Alaska Native culture.
You're listening to Bristol Bay and Beyond on KDLG. I'm Dave Benninger. Thanks to Anna Louise Hosseth there for sharing a snapshot of what just one of our many area grads are aiming for in the weeks, months, and years ahead. Well, after years of looking to the Environmental Protection Agency as the surest ally in the fight against PEBL, the tables have sort of turned. The agency announced it is backing off of its attempt to kill the PEBL mine before the company applies for permits. In return, EPA can keep the Bristol Bay Watershed Assessment for later use. It will still evaluate the project under existing rules, and PEBL will drop all of the lawsuits. Tom Collier is PEBL's CEO and joins us again for the latest this week. Tom, we talked to you last week and we got a sense that this settlement was coming, and we saw some pushback locally, which I'm going to ask you about in a minute. But first, could you just give us the details in your mind of as what has been reached between your company and the nation's Environmental Protection Agency here?
Yeah, what we were after in the settlement was a return to normalized permitting, and you know, that's a process where you prepare your description of your project and take it to the Corps of Engineers. They retain an independent third party to do an exhaustive, rigorous scientific review, an environmental impact statement. And at the conclusion of that process, then the Corps of Engineers makes a decision as to whether it will issue a record of decision that supports a permit. And the way the statute's supposed to work, in our opinion, at that point, EPA can determine whether there are extraordinary circumstances that were not taken into consideration by the Corps and issue a veto. That's the process that we're now going to be in.
We've heard you discuss exactly those talking points before, that you want the chance to enter into normal permitting. There's some terms to this agreement that require the company pursue that within a certain amount of time now.
That's correct. So we have to file our permit application within 30 months, and we're eager to get on with that. We've got a team working on that, and are pretty confident that that's a time frame that we'll meet. In fact, you know, my goal is that we meet it by a long shot. And then the EPA cannot do anything under the Clean Water Act with respect to the project until there's a final EIS or until 48 months from the date of the settlement, whichever occurs first.
Tom, yesterday, many of your opponents, many of the region's leadership were out for a rally and a press conference to push back against this. One thing that I asked of them was, do the regulations that exist today, are they rigorous enough to protect this region with whatever plan you might put on the table here?
Look, they're the most rigorous in the world. And for 45 years, they've worked for the country. I think they're going to continue to work. The notion that our permitting system is broken and therefore people that object to projects ought to be able to go in and prevent people from even applying for a permit is just absurd. We've spent $750 million getting ready to go into permitting. To design a project that we think deals with the environmental challenges in that region. And we don't think we're going to be allowed to build, turn one shovel full of dirt, unless the Corps of Engineers, after a rigorous process, determines that the project that we have put forward isn't going to do significant damage to the environment. And then we'll move ahead. Then we'll get our permit.
There were two points raised yesterday that I'd like to ask you to maybe address briefly. One is that folks feel like Pebble waited out the clock to get a favorable administration to do what they say was a backroom deal to get the EPA off their back. Part two of that is there's a big sense of deflated disappointment amongst people who participated in the EPA's efforts over years with public comments and visits and the rest. What do you say about the backroom deals, and what do you say to folks who had put a lot of effort and energy in a public process that suddenly seems to have vanished here this morning?
Well, I find it, first of all, I just say the irony is dripping off of the comments made by our opponents on backroom deals. I would remind all of your listeners that we were able to convince a federal judge to halt the issue a preliminary injunction against EPA going forward with its proposed process just because of the fact that it had been ginned up by backroom deals. That was the whole nature of the lawsuit we brought. And for them to turn around and say that we have stopped it with a backroom deal when we've got a federal judge that has essentially concluded that they started it with a backroom deal is ludicrous to me. There was no backroom deal here. There was a new administration that came in that believes in the rule of law and normal permitting. Never in the history of the 45-year Clean Water Act has someone had a permit vetoed before they even got to file an application, and that's not the rule of law. And this administration stands up for that, and I'm proud that they do, because that's the way America ought to work. There's a process for those that still have questions and concerns about our project. It's the EIS process. Our specific plan will be on the table, and they'll have a chance to point out any concerns that they might have with it. But that's a fair process, and that's the one that's now going to make the decision as to whether this project gets built or doesn't get built. And we think we're going to come out ahead in that process and be able to build our project.
And the clock is ticking, 30 months. The public should get to see a plan put forward finally within that time. Is that correct?
Well, and I think far in advance of that deadline expiring.
Tom Collier is the CEO of Pebble Mine and joining us from Anchorage. Tom, we appreciate this update this week, and I'm sure we'll speak again soon. Thanks so much for the time.
Thank you.
Well, and yesterday, several of the region's leaders and dozens of area residents spoke out against this deal and against Pebble. Here's what many of them had to say.
As many of you know, with new administration in the White House, we have a pro-development, kind of anti-environment situation going on.
We're here today to express our great sense of betrayal and outrage as it appears that the Pebble Limited Partnership and EPA are set to announce a settlement concerning the proposed Clean Water Act protections our people have fought so hard for.
You know, I'm sure there's going to be legal challenges, you know, taking to the streets, standing in front of bulldozers. Our response is, again, going to be multifaceted.
So you're willing to stand in front of bulldozers and lie down in front of bulldozers yourself?
Yes, sir.
And you think a lot of other people are, too?
I believe so.
It is a day of disappointment, but you know what? We're going to stand united, and people are going to try to divide us and conquer us, but we're going to stand united and stay firm and get out there and rally what we're doing.
What we're seeing with the Pebble Partnership right now is, going back to the old school tactics of trying to essentially buy out some of the residents and have us versus them mentality going forward, when no matter what they can do, it's still going to be the vast majority of the region that's strongly opposes this project. I tell you what, I'm pretty disappointed by what I've been seeing so far.
You know, future generations, that's our hope. That's what we need to strive for, is making a good life that is going to be suitable for everybody. And our salmon have been here and showed us that fish and salmon are happiness. It's a good life to live, and we don't want large-scale development here in Bristol Bay.
Learning that a foreign mining company is making a deal with the EPA behind closed doors to the detriment of the local people is not right.
We've been fighting this fight for the last decade, and I'd certainly like to see it end sooner than that. And I mean, this region means so much to our family as far as fishing and just the whole lifestyle that we live here, and I want to see it protected for my generation, but the ones after us and my children's generations as well.
For more than a decade now, Pebble has created stress and uncertainty among our people and our businesses. Bristol Bay needs and deserves certainty that our sustainable industries and world-class salmon fisheries will continue. Any settlement between EPA and Pebble at this time moves us further away from that potential result.
I sit here today with tribal, native corporation, commercial fishermen, economic development, and political leaders of Bristol Bay united to protect our home in the continued opposition to the Pebble Mine.
The salmon here were here before any economic development was here. The ancestors were here before any of the fishers were here.
What's the message to Governor Walker, President Trump, the EPA?
Help protect the salmon in Bristol Bay and all the tributaries in Alaska that have salmon.
I think that our ancestors will be proud of what we've done up until now. And for us to just stand back, that's just not who we are.
One Last Time by Rhiannon Olson. So here's the thing. Our class has come a long way from freshman year. We are much smarter and more mature to walk out into the real world. We are all graduating, and there is absolutely nothing standing in the way of that but ourselves and how much time and effort we put in towards school, and all of the work that needs to be done before the time comes where our names are being called to walk out from behind those closed gym doors and walk out into the crowd of people awaiting to take our pictures, holding up that little blue folder that contains our diploma inside that says, "Hey, look at me. I'm actually capable of getting this diploma and smart enough to graduate from this place." And congratulating us on our day of accomplishment. Senior year definitely can be an eye-opener on how important it is and how one hell of a roller coaster it can be. Because everyone knows that this is the last time we will be sitting in class listening to lectures all day. This is the last time we will be getting homework that has some lenient on the deadlines and staying up late for those important tests that is going to be given in class. This is the last time for some of the student athletes to spike their last high school volleyball over that great big black and white net to score the winning point and traveling back home to practice for the next big game coming the following week. This is the last time for the students playing basketball to get their plays and moves down to put that basketball through the basket just one more time before those carefree games turn into something more serious and meaningful. This is the last time we are going to walk down these hallways full of our friends and the buzz of many different conversations. This is the last time we will be seeing all of our friends every single day of the week before we graduate and have our lives turn into something that is going to change our whole entire life. Before we go out and find what we want and what we are going to do to help us survive in this world. Yes, high school has its great ups and terrible downs, but those 4 years are what is leading and teaching us what is waiting for us in the real world. Everyone can't wait to be done with high school and move on with their lives, but we all know that there's a little part of us that doesn't really want to believe that this is all we have left, and we have to accept it whether we want to or not. All of the teachers have taught us everything we need to know, and that we are ready to move on to something so much better. The rest of our lives are waiting, and if you ask me, I have a feeling that everything will be okay.
Rhiannon Olson, thanks for sharing that poem. We hope everything is okay for all of you moving on to that next chapter. Speaking of next chapters, Ian Foe came to Bristol Bay as a biologist with the Department of Fish and Game. But in April, he made a move he has wanted to make for a while, a move to self-employment. He left his job with ADF&G to become a barista at Tide Table Coffee, an artist, and a personal trainer. KDLG's Avery Lill caught up with Foe as he led a couple of Dillingham high schoolers through a workout to find out more about the personal training business he's been developing.
Okay, we're going to run through a circuit twice, okay? So we're going to do chin up, rope crunch, dumbbell row, and then leg lift.
Ian Foe stands in the back of the metal shipping container in his yard that he's converted into a gym. He coaches 15-year-old Jesse Noden and 17-year-old Justin Dye through the last circuit in their half-hour session. Foe gives directions, and both boys get to work without a word. They move between lifting free weights and doing a couple of different ab workouts.
Good. Oh, good. Good. Awesome.
Both athletes began personal training to improve their wrestling and have continued with Foe to improve their overall fitness. Dye has been working out with him for 3 years.
The kids in my grade, you know, they're in wrestling and all that too, and, you know, same age and all this, but I can definitely tell, you know, I'm a lot stronger and stuff. I think it's good to just get above and beyond, you know. You gotta put in that extra work to get better and, you know, do what it takes to be a champ at what you're doing.
Near the back of the Connex, there are several columns of numbers written in permanent marker. They run from floor to ceiling.
It shows all my maxes when we first start off and then till now, and there's a huge difference. And our first maxes, we started on January 20th, about 3 years ago, and started off with benching 120 pounds, squatting 155, deadlifting 170. You can see how over the 3 years, the weights have definitely gone up.
Dye and Noden's maxes are by no means the only things written on the walls of the container.
There's a bunch of quotes up here by either famous people, you know, like we have Napoleon Hill, Benjamin Franklin, Oprah. One of my favorite quotes, doing your best at this moment puts you in the best place for the next moment. Oprah said that.
That's Foe. With a Connex full of motivational quotes, he's aiming to spread the word in Dillingham about fitness. His clients range from high school athletes to folks looking to get into shape and lose weight for the first time in years.
Basically, my main goal is to educate people and teach people how to take care of their bodies, really. Everybody starts somewhere, right? So something they can take, you know, for the rest of their lives.
For his part, Fo began weight training with his father in high school to improve his football game. The interest grew from there, and he wasn't ready to give it up when he finished playing college football.
I was really still into working out, and I ended up getting into bodybuilding a little bit. So I did physique competitions, more of like a fitness physique model competition. So I did okay at that and started to compete nationally at that.
While he was competing, he also began helping other people get into shape as a personal trainer. He found that aspect of weight training fulfilling as well.
Well, I'm always proud when I just see somebody accomplish their goals. You know, I get pretty much as excited as that person.
Fo gave up bodybuilding competitions to move to Dillingham 3 years ago. He's an avid sport fisherman, and he's wanted to live in Bristol Bay since high school. So he took a job as a biologist with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. But his personal training business has grown. He has 10 clients now, and Fo stepped down from his job with Fish and Game in April. Between his personal training, selling artwork, and helping with his wife's business, Thai Table Coffee, he's been self-employed for about a month.
Working at Fish and Game was definitely a dream come true for me. It's something that I worked really hard at, and I loved every minute of it, and it helped me grow. And when it comes down to it, I've always wanted to be self-employed. What I'm doing now, I'm able to touch a lot of lives and add value to a lot of lives.
Come mid-June, when the heat and the bugs make his Connex gym uninviting, Fo will close up shop for the summer. But in October, he'll be back at it, coaching folks to their fitness goals, one inspirational quote at a time. In Dillingham, I'm Avery Lill.
My name is Shanita Sorensen. I am a senior at Dillingham High School. After high school, I plan on going to Alaska Pacific University in Anchorage, Alaska to major in environmental and marine science for a bachelor's degree. I will be writing a poem I wrote called Times Are Changing. Young children discovering the exquisite elements of life, grasping each day offered, the last vestiges of innocence, a significant moment to cherish. The granules of sand falling, a reluctant reminder of time, the way it slips through fingers like sand creeping from a prominent hourglass, deceitful to life, it is only temporary. Comprehending maturity, evolving into a thriving entity, obstacles are merciless, yet there is a harmony between it all. Each second slips by, like water in cupped hands, the future is uncertain. Sand grains dissolve, the hourglass is empty. Footsteps begin to disappear. Like a boat without a paddle, the future ends here.
My name is Katie Moore. I'm a senior at Dillingham High School. I'm 18, and I will be reading a poem that I wrote. It's called My Advice to Seniors. Senior year is a strange time. While others around you are angry with someone or something, you're kind of just chilling. You stop caring about the silly stuff. You stop caring about what your hair looks like. You no longer care if your eyebrows are on fleek. Who are you trying to impress here anyway? All these people look 12. Home is weird too, because your mom, suddenly she's looking up to you, asking you about hashtag adult things, and even your sister, now she's asking you for fashion and makeup advice. Your dad now asks you to lift the heavy boxes, and your brother is asking you about new movies. Now all the kids in younger classes look up to you with nervous eyes darting around. But how are you? Make sure to check in. Relax, take up yoga, and drink lots of water. Do you. Do not worry about what Stacy is saying. Stacy has nothing on you. Turn off your phone. Take Sundays to relax on the couch like it's a beach and gaze at the TV playing Shameless like it's the ocean with the tide rushing in and out. Don't forget to do your homework, though. Really. Lastly, grind. Work harder than any salmon fighting the current, harder than any mother bear searching for food for her cubs. This is the year that everything matters. Make it count.
We're going to end this week with the powerful testimony of a young man from Dillingham who is back from the brink. Jonathan Larson, who goes by JJ, is on a new path to sobriety after his addictions had nearly destroyed everything in his life. Recently, this young man has shared his story with the state senate and at this week's community classes on opioid addictions. He sat down with me Thursday morning, and just a note, we'll post this full interview online at kdlg.org later today. JJ, thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
So we want to be very honest about where you're at right now, because you're at a crucial step where you are now sober, but you're at the very beginning stage of this. Can you just describe where you're at sort of in this journey?
So I'm 4 months sober now, and, you know, I'm just starting to understand what it is to be sober and building a life in sobriety. It's been somewhat of a struggle. I've been home for over a month now, and, you know, the first week was a little tough, but the important thing for me was to, you know, see what I can do for my community, a part of this, you know, that's what this is. And, you know, it's, I kind of explained it to someone last night, it's like I'm taking the first necessary steps on a journey that I've chosen to take, and I could kind of see the, you know, where it can lead to.
You're looking through the tunnel.
Yeah.
There's a light down there.
Yeah, exactly. Something that I never seen before.
Right. Can you share what led up to that? Can you share where the where the struggle began and sort of what happened?
Well, I started drinking and smoking weed at around 10, and mostly it was when my mom died. I kind of just didn't want to deal with the pain and emotions that came with that. So I, you know, I used alcohol and marijuana to, you know, hide that. And, you know, I had a lot of fun with it also. You know, it wasn't just bad times. And, you know, I was one of those people that said I'd never do hard drugs. And mm-hmm. eventually I got to the point where I was doing prescription pills and cocaine. And that was around my senior year in high school.
Okay.
And then my brother passed away when I was 19. And that's... And also my best friend 6 months later, and that's when the addiction really started to take a strong hold with me. And I was doing prescription pills, Oxycontin, and cocaine. And after a few years of that, the pills just weren't enough anymore, and they got too expensive, and that's when I started doing heroin. And, you know, it just started out with a little here and a little there, and eventually got to the point where it was like with the pills and whatnot is where it was all I cared about.
He was in college but began to attend class less and less. Larson says no matter what happened in his life, nothing could shake him out of the need to get high. Not when his girlfriend left him, not his family and friends confronting him, not even having a son. He says he could go for short stints of trying to get clean, periods of time that might last a few weeks before the urge was too great.
I'd always tell myself, you know, I'll just try it once, and I might, you know, do it one day, and then a few days later try it again, and then within a few weeks I'd be doing it every day and getting to the point where if I don't have it, I'm in withdrawal, and I'm telling myself I need it, you know, because I'm hurting.
Life was spiraling out of control for J.J. Larson. The old drugs had been partly to deal with pain, but also partly just for fun. Prescription pills had had an addictive quality that he says caught him by surprise. By the time he came to heroin, which he knew enough about to be afraid of, it was too late.
Definitely, once I started using it, it was like kind of fell in love with it, right, at first, and then it just... It went downhill very fast. Mm. It wasn't like I was able to maintain a lifestyle on it for a while. I was constantly, you know, lying to my family and my friends. Mm. And, you know, what money I did have went to it. Bills weren't being paid. And eventually got to the point where I was, you know, stealing from family, you know, lying about what I needed money for, borrowing money to pay bills, and then yet those bills weren't paid, you know, when...
Which years before you never would have imagined about yourself, I would guess.
No, definitely not. You know, when I took that first pill, never would I imagine that it would lead me to a heroin habit that would essentially... You know, it was very close to taking my life.
If there was a rock bottom to Larson's addiction story, it came at the very beginning of this year.
It was on New Year's this year, New Year's Eve. My son had hurt his arm and was at the hospital. And, you know, as I was sitting there, the more important thing was drugs to me. You know, even though my son's at the hospital hurting, you know, it was what was on my mind was, you know, how I was gonna get my next fix. And after, you know, my son had gotten seen and been taken care of, I started thinking about that and everything else leading up to that.
You wanted better for yourself, your family wanted better for you. How did you take the leap?
I woke up one morning and, you know, I was tired of living that lifestyle of every day waking up sick and wondering how I was going to be okay that day, how I was going to find money to be okay. I went online and looked up this addiction hotline number, called it, and got some information about the, you know, treatment centers and insurance. You know, I was informed that I need to figure out what insurance I have, and I was very fortunate that my stepmom has a great insurance company that they gave me an extension, and I was able to get covered through them to go to treatment in Seattle.
There he began a 28-day inpatient treatment program. He says one of the important parts of his story is that he had insurance to cover the program that cost more than $10,000.
There's a lot of people out there that aren't as fortunate as I am, you know, to have that. And I think that's another, you know, thing that's very unfortunate, that, you know, it's so expensive to get that treatment.
When people look at recovery options, there's things like methadone, there's things like trying to go cold turkey, there's things like treatment. What was the philosophy behind this treatment idea, and why has it worked so far for you?
Well, they stressed no mind-altering substances, so they, you know, if at all possible, they wouldn't, you know, give out Suboxone or methadone. You would go in for a detox period where you'd see the doctor every few hours. You know, they'd check up on you, make sure you're not gonna have any medical emergency. Sure. And you know, I was in pain. I was very uncomfortable. I wanted to get something, you know, and they knew I didn't need it. I just wanted it and gave me as little as possible, like something to help me sleep.
Sure.
You know, maybe some ibuprofen.
After he left the treatment facility, he went to a sobriety house where he could come and go, but agreed to urinalysis and a couple hours a day of counseling programs. Others failed their time there. For Larson, it was a perfect bridge to prove to himself that he could live without the drugs.
Since I was 10 years old, I wanted to be high on something. And now, you know, instead of, like, one thing that I've been going through recently is, like, I would always have to do something, like, smoke weed or get drunk or maybe heroin before I could do anything. So, like, I'm getting to the point now where, like, I have to get myself motivated to do things.
Without it.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's not easy. You know, it's tough, but at the same time, it's worth it, you know. I'm finally starting to feel that, a little bit of that drive, like waking up and, you know, being able to go throughout my day.
He's been back for about a month now and is taking each new day as a battle to be won, keeping himself busy getting ready for fishing, looking for crew who were clean, and a big part has been humbly opening himself up to others who might want to know more about his own struggle and recovery. He spoke to the state Senate, giving testimony that caught the attention of the state's chief medical officer. This week he joined the community classes on opioid addiction and shared his story there too. I asked if he had any advice for the younger listeners out there, those who might be vulnerable to trying these highly addictive, life-crushing substances, either to fit in or deal with their own pain.
I think, like, if you're having a hard time, you know, troubles at home, troubles with friends, any kind of hard times, instead of bottling it up and keeping it inside, find someone that you can talk to about it, you know. That was one thing I never did, was talked about what I was going through. I held everything inside, and when those emotions or that pain came up, it was much easier to turn to drugs and alcohol. And then also, peer pressure is a big thing. Mm-hmm. You know, it was something for me, is I always wanted to be cool. I always wanted to be part of the in crowd, and drinking mm-hmm. allowed me to do that. And I think if you're drinking to be, you know, or using drugs to be friends with somebody or to, you know, get closer to someone, you know, it's not something that you want to get into. You know, be yourself. I think, you know, don't be afraid to be yourself, no matter what that is. You know, as I'm starting to be sober and realize who I am, I think not being ashamed of who I am is important.
J.J. Larson, we commend you for being who you are, for standing up to share your story, which I know is not easy. Proud to hear of your success, and we wish you the best. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Dave.
And that's it for this week's show. We hope we can bring many more stories of recovery to you on this program as our community beats back this devastating epidemic. Look for this and past episodes of Bristol Bay and Beyond at our website, kdlg.org. Reach out with feedback and story ideas. Give us a call here at the station anytime or send an email to dave@kdlg.org. My thanks to the KDLG News crew for their help this week. I'm Dave Benninger. See you back here next Friday.